So I'm going to invite you all to have your seat. We will discuss minutes and the our new members who are observing, but I'd like to, at this point now, turn it over completely to Justice Epstein, who will be presenting here at our education program. And I want to say with little further ado, because I know Justice Epstein is doing us a favor by being here and also has a plane to catch. Please, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. It's an honor to be here, and particularly an honor to be here with you as Chief Justice and the distinguished members of the Council. That would be all of you, and the distinguished future members of the Council. I suggest that if you have pen in hand, you put it down. I don't believe I'm going to say anything particularly notable worth taking a note, so put them down. Instead, what's going to fall is a romp through some of the more interesting, I think, anecdotal information from parts of the last century and some other anecdotal information that you never know where it may stand you in good stead, but certainly it'll do no harm, and I hope you'll enjoy it. The state courts and even the United States Supreme Courts were finding their way from the beginning towards developing an institution of the courts and their respective judiciaries, developing the common law and the great work that they do. And there's anecdotal information about all of them. The United States Supreme Court had a lot to say this morning, as I'm sure you've heard by now. I have just a couple of little anecdotes to share with you about that. The top floor of the court, directly over where the courtroom where the justices sit, is laid out as a basketball court. It's a full-length basketball court. Wizard White did that. And they have a rule that there is no dribbling when the court is in session. And it's referred to as the highest court in the land. They also have work, as you probably know, in the term system. So everything has to get out by the end of the term. And the end of the term is the end of June. And they sometimes lap over a little bit for the first few days in July. But the 4th of July is absolutely it. So toward the end of the term, everybody is working very hard, particularly the research attorneys, getting out the opinions, revising the opinions, getting out dissents, concurrences, and all the other things they do, because they've got to meet the July 4th deadline. And the local joke up there is that Independence Day takes on a new meaning, because once they arrive at it, they're finally done. Other states have anecdotal information. I just want to share one piece of it. A terribly interesting and remarkable case from New York. Over a century ago, a member of the New York Supreme Court, which is their general jurisdiction trial court, was elevated to the Court of Appeal, which is their highest court. And he had an appeal from a case he had decided. So the question was, should he recuse or not? And he thought about it, and he considered that, well, who knows more about this case than I do? I tried it. So he decided, no, he should not recuse, and he wrote an opinion on why it is. He insisted on sitting on the panel that's going to review the work that he had done. It was necessary to amend the Constitution of the State of New York to get around that opinion, and I'm going to give you the citation of that opinion. I have almost no citations to share with you, but I'm going to give you this one because I know that once you hear it, you'll never forget it. One New York, one. But I digress. This is the way it was over a century ago. California was a nascent state. It was acquired by the United States as a result of the war with Mexico. And when that war was ending, there was a group that met to work out the treaty in a town near Mexico City called Guadalupe Hidalgo. The American plenipotentiary was meeting with the Mexican representatives, and word reached him from Washington that he was fired. It was very difficult to get a message from Washington to the central part of Mexico, but they managed to get it. And he knew he was fired. He was instructed to have no more dealings with the Mexican government, pack up your stuff, and return to Washington immediately. He did none of that. He continued to negotiate the treaty. He came back with the treaty in hand. One of the things the Mexican representatives insisted on, and no one knows why, but they did, was a provision in the treaty that safeguarded the water rights of Indians who would become would be living in what would be the United States. Over a century later, some enormous litigation rose up about rights, water rights in the Colorado River. The principal antagonists were the state of Arizona and the state of California, but all the states in the Colorado River Basin were involved in this thing. And the United States attorney appeared in the litigation to represent all the Indian tribes that drank of the Colorado River and pressing their rights. The delegation or the group section in the state attorney general's office responsible for the litigation was having some real trouble dealing with this provision in the treaty. The treaty was so good that even though they fired the plenipotentiary, Nicholas Trist, Congress ratified it. It was a ratified treaty, but somebody came up with the argument that since the American representative had been fired and he knew it, he had no authority to do anything. Therefore, the treaty is not valid, and therefore the rights of the Indians went with the treaty that's invalid. Till somebody pointed out, well, doesn't that mean we're all citizens of Mexico? Oh. And at that point, the argument was dropped and not put forward further. The flag behind you is the Bear flag, and beneath it are the words California Republic. We're not far from Sonoma, where the Bear flag revolt occurred, and there was, for a time, something called the California Republic. It was really a farce. There never really was a republic. The only real republic to join the Union was Texas. It really was. But nevertheless, California was admitted. And behind you is the Great Seal, which was adopted about that time. And sitting directly behind the Chief Justice is Minerva. That's the lady you see holding the spear. I don't know if you know why it is that Minerva is there. She is the Greco-Roman god of wisdom. That's not the reason she's there. The reason that she is there is, according to the mythology, Minerva sprang full-blown from the head of Zeus and did not go through a gestation period. And so it was that California, unlike almost any of the other states beyond the first 13, did not go through a territorial period, but was immediately admitted full-blown as a state. Now, I'm not sure what you'll do with that information now that you have it, but I couldn't leave here without sharing it with you. The first thing that a state has to have is a constitution. And the general who was really, in effect, the governor of the state at the beginning, called a convention, and delegates came together at Colton Hall in Monterey to draft a constitution. I once had occasion to go through the recording, the minutes of that session. I really had an issue that involved going back to the 1849 Constitution. But there are two passages I recall that seem to stand out. One is they're voting money to pay for hauling ice from the Sierras to Colton Hall to try to cool the place down. And the other was an argument by one of the delegates objecting to the stenographic reporting of their debates. Because, as he explained, none of us know what we're talking about, and this will simply make that clear to posterity forever. Nevertheless, it was done. And the group brought together, they all came from, virtually all, from other states, and they brought with them the little snippets of the constitutions of their states that they have. And these things got into the original 1849 Constitution here, there, and everywhere. So there's a bit from Iowa and a bit from Ohio and some from Michigan, Pennsylvania, New York, and a melange from a great many states. But nevertheless, the work was done. The state was started and the Great Seal adopted. The first Chief Justice, as you know, is Soranus Hastings. He had been Chief Justice of Iowa. He left to go into private practice. My wife's ancestor was a partner of Justice Hastings, but then he left and went back toward the east somewhere. Hastings was the founder of the Hastings College of the Law and served as Chief Justice for a relatively brief time. He was shortly succeeded by U.C. Murray. That's not U.C., but H-U-G-H-C Murray. Murray, like so many others in California at the time, were attracted by the gold rush. The gold rush thoroughly transformed California, and he wanted to get there while the gold still was there. So he got the first boat he could find out of New York, sailed down to Panama, walked across the Isthmus of Panama, got the first boat he could find on the Pacific side to get to California as soon as he could. And that darn boat stopped at virtually every fishing village and port on the west coast of Central America. Murray was getting more and more frustrated at this. Finally, when it stopped at Cabo San Lucas, at the tail southern end of Baja California, he walked off the ship and walked to San Francisco. He was genuinely an A-type. He is probably best known, though, for what I think is the most notorious and blatantly racist opinion by the California court, certainly, and probably by any court at all. I stumbled across this when I was an undergraduate in a footnote of something I was reading. I think it's fairly well known now, but perhaps you haven't heard of it. The case is People versus Hall. Hall was charged with homicide, and the principal evidence against him was a testimony of two Chinese. California had a law at the time that no white person could be convicted on the testimony of any Indian, Negro, or mulatto. So the argument, the inventive argument being made by Hall's lawyers was that since the witnesses were Chinese, the conviction is invalid because, you see, Chinese are Indians. So how is that? Well, the argument ran, the ancestors of the American Indians had come over the Aleutian Archipelago from Asia, and Asia really is China, so they are actually, the Indians are Chinese. The argument was that since they came from Asia and all Chinese are Asian, then all Asians must be Chinese. It's like saying that since French citizens of France are citizens of Europe, all Europeans must be French. But the Chief Justice went on and said that even if were that were not the case, we would reach the same result as a matter of public policy. Public policy? Why, yes. He found it astounding that Chinese could be given rights of this kind. You can find what he said set out even after all these years. It's incredible to read. The citation to this tome is 4 Cal 399. It's an 1854 decision. Among the other things that Chief Justice Murray said was that the same rule which would admit them to testify would admit them to all the equal rights of citizenship. And we might soon see them at the polls, in the jury box, on the bench, and even at legislative halls. How about that? It was a 2-1 decision. I will quote you the entire dissent, and it is as follows. From the opinion of the Chief Justice, I most respectfully dissent. That was it. The other vote, the second vote to do this, was by a man named Solomon Heidenfeld, and there's an interesting story about Heidenfeld as well. Must have been a born bigot, but he certainly was by the time he got here. He came from South Carolina via Texas and arrived in California, where he certainly became a member of the Supreme Court. How that happened, I don't know. He was known for an opinion he wrote in a personal injury case. Someone had fallen into an excavation in front of a shop or building in San Jose and sued the proprietor. And the defense was, well, you were drunk at the time. And Heidenfeld, in writing an opinion in favor of the plaintiff, said, a drunk man is entitled to a safe street as a sober one and much more in need of it. Heidenfeld, after he left the court, which was shortly after this opinion, went into private practice and was doing that even after the Civil War. After the Civil War, Congress passed something called the Ironclad Law. And the idea was to discourage former Confederates from holding office anywhere. What it provided is that a public office could not be held by anyone who did not swear allegiance to the United States and, in effect, renounce the Confederacy. So somebody with no particular morals wouldn't care about that, would swear to anything. But somebody who really believed in the Confederacy would have trouble doing it. Anyway, the term officer was broadly construed to include lawyers because they're, after all, officers of the court. Heidenfeld had been retained in a will contest, and he had a draft for, I think it was $10,000, big money in that time, in his coat. And he comes to court ready for trial, and the judge says, Judge Heidenfeld, my clerk tells me we don't have a copy of your oath on file. If you just sign the oath, we'll get on with the case. And he stood up and said, refused to sign that oath, handed the $10,000 check back to his clients, and walked out. And walked into history. Little has been heard from him since. A few years later, we come to perhaps the most colorful period in our history, and fortunately, I hope one never to be repeated. And this has to do with another Chief Justice, David Terry. Terry's great antagonist was Stephen Fields, and their portraits are somewhere in this building, along with the portraits of other former members of the Supreme Court. And the two of them look like they could have been, they could have posed for the Smith brothers, you know, the cough drops with their fulsome beards. Terry was a short, feisty guy. He was seemed to be constantly in trouble. During the vigilante period, he was trying to perform a citizen's arrest. And he accomplished that by stabbing this guy with a Bowie knife. And he was in one scrape after another. So, of course, he became Chief Justice of California in those days somehow. He did not get along with Stephen Fields, who was an associate justice, about whom more in a moment. But Fields did have a comment about Terry. He said that there is nobody who can write in passable English and makes so little sense as David Terry. This didn't set well with Terry, about which more soon. Terry also had a quarrel with Senator Sharon. Sharon, who I think was the family for whom the hotels were named. He made a fortune in Nevada silver. He became United States Senator from California and held other posts of distinction. But he made a lot of enemies, and one of them was, I'm ahead of myself. The senator I'm talking about now, I'll get to Sharon, is Senator Broderick. Senator Broderick had been a friend of Terry's, but they had a falling out, and Broderick later said this, "I have hitherto spoken of him, Terry, as an honest man, as the only honest man on the bench of a miserable, corrupt Supreme Court. But now I find I was mistaken. I take it all back. He's just as bad as all the others." And there's much worse that he said. They didn't get along particularly well. After some of these remarks, Terry challenged him to a duel. And they actually fought a duel. Terry had the good grace to resign as Chief Justice before the duel, which occurred across the bay in Marin County. David shot Broderick and killed him. And dueling, killing the course of a duel was a crime even then. So since it had been, the crime had been committed in Marin County, Terry was indicted and his case was going to go to trial for homicide, probably murder. But all the witnesses were in San Francisco. So on the day the case was set to be heard, they're waiting for the ferry to arrive from San Francisco with the witnesses. And the ferry was late. And Terry was insisting that the case be heard immediately. And the judge presiding apparently agreed with that. The prosecution had no evidence to present, so that was that. Terry, now in private practice, continued to have a colorful career. And that takes us to the next phase of this, where Stephen Fields reenters. Sharon now, the Sheraton Hotel, I think. Sharon's mistress was a lady named Althea Hill, Sarah Althea Hill. And he put her up at the hotel and then broke up with her. Wanted her to leave the hotel. She refused to go. So he had the door taken off, shredded the curtains, pulled up the rug, and she finally had to leave. And she sued him for divorce. His response was, "What divorce? We were never married." And there began one of the most incredible series of litigation in the state's history. There are 10 decisions of the state Supreme Court that came out of that, 10 by the United States Circuit Court of Appeal, and 2 by the United States Supreme Court. All of this is recounted, by the way, in Richard Robbins' article in the next to last issue of the California Legal History, put out by the California Supreme Court Historical Society. Well, somehow this case got into federal court. How a divorce got into federal court, I'm not sure. Rahm explains it, and I'm not sure, as I say, that I understand it. Somehow it did. And by this time, Field was a member of the United States Supreme Court. And then as now, members of the Supreme Court are assigned circuits, and they are the circuit judge. And even now, they have some duties as a circuit judge, that they hear emergency petitions before they can be considered by the full court. But in those days, they actually sat as a trial judge. John Marshall sat as a trial judge, I believe, in the trial of Aaron Burr. And Stephen Field found himself in California presiding over this case between between Hill and Sharon. Her then husband, and now a lawyer, was David Terry. When Judge Fields announced his decision, which was that there had never been a marriage at all, the marriage certificate was a sham, Ms. Hill stood up and asked Judge Field how much he had taken to make that decision, upon which Fields found her in direct contempt and sentenced her to a few days. But when that was going on, Terry walked over to protect his wife and tried to slug the bailiff. In any event, he was found in contempt and did some serious time and never forgot. The story ends not too long after that in a little town called Lathrop. It still exists. So you can see the sign if you're going down, I think it's the 5 on the highway. It was a railroad stop, and it was the last stop on the train on its way to San Francisco. So it was a dining stop. People would get off and have dinner at a restaurant at the railroad station. So Justice Fields and his bailiff were there. Fields was having breakfast, and they see Terry walking into the dining room with blood in his eye, and he's heading right toward Fields. Now, the stories vary whether he actually reached Fields or not. One story is he actually pushed his face. Another that is he didn't get that far. But the bailiff stood up to protect the judge and shot Terry dead. That was the end of Terry. The bailiff, a man named Nagel, was then himself charged with murder, and that led to still another decision by the United States Supreme Court, N. Ray Nagel. He got out of it on immunity. He was protecting a federal officer, and that kind of trumped everything. And N. Ray Nagel is still on the books, is still a law, and so far as I know, that's the last of these series of cases and the last of my citations, which is 128 U.S. 289. We all recovered from those events and that tumultuous time. The California Supreme Court went on to become the great court and to become the most cited court by any court in the land other than the United States Supreme Court, and reached the distinction that it now occupies. Well, that's the way it was, and that's the way it is now. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Justice Epstein. I wanted to say, because I wanted to get you started in case there wasn't enough time, so I'm going to actually give your introduction now, because and the context, and that is I was concerned about your time, but I still want to say that all of us know you, and you've been educating many of us for years, and we are graced by your presence. And I always knew you had the history of our jurisprudence, of our court here, and I'm so glad that we finally had an opportunity to invite you to be here, because you really have expanded our knowledge, and I know that none of us knew the story of why Minerva was on the seal. I know that. But I also want to point out for others that you know that Justice Epstein was appointed to the Court of Appeal in Los Angeles. Then presiding justice of Division 4, Arlie Woods, was told by none other than Bernie Witkin when hearing of the appointment of Justice Epstein, quote, "Arlie, you've won the lottery," end quote. And so one of the many things that we can be proud of in California, as you know, is the quality of our judicial education that all of us receive, trial court and appellate also, and the Supreme Court, and our educational resources. And Presiding Justice Norman Epstein has contributed to both, and that is as a former member of this Judicial Council, also as chair of and long-term faculty for the Center for Judicial Education and Research, and co-author with B.E. Witkin of the well-known and much-used treatise, I know, used it many times myself, California Criminal Law. And I believe, based on what you've said, I've always known that it's important to look back on where we've been and where we are today and the history of the characters who have inhabited our benches, as well as our efforts to move beyond the Hidalgo Treaty and also to determine water rights and do it in an educated fashion. And so I think the work you have told us about, the work you do, how you've educated us, and that juxtaposed against our Futures Commission gives us a sense of belonging to a rich judiciary. So I thank you and join you again in a round of applause for your presentation today. Thank you.